Yes, Honest Actors is back with brand new episodes every Friday. To help me continue releasing new episodes without a sponsor, or to say thanks for your favourite old ones, click the support link in the episode description. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. It's a one-off, feeling generous, good deed for the day sort of thing. Think of it as bumping into me and buying me a drink. To find out more, click the support link. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show.
Yeah, mine's a large red.
I hate those guys.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
My name is John Heffernan, and you're listening to the Honest Actors Podcast.
Hi, my name's Jonathan Harden, and you're listening to Series 3 of the Honest Actors Podcast, sponsored by Today Tix. If you want great offers on theatre tickets, access Today seats on your mobile, and exclusive front row lotteries, you need Today Tix, the ticketing app that lets you see theatre differently. To get tickets with no queues and no fuss, download Today Tix now from the App Store and Google Play. So I'm back 2 weeks later, back into a regular routine, thank the baby Jesus. I'm releasing today another of the older interviews. This one is from way back in the summer of 2017. What were you doing in August 2017? Cast your mind back. Well, I was at the National Theatre Studio interviewing John Heffernan. I really enjoyed my time with John. It was probably one of the very, very first interviews for this series I recorded when I was thinking about releasing it later that year. So it will be a surprise to John when I email him this morning to say that his episode is going out today, having not heard from me since August of 2017. Anyway, I have nothing else to say except to ask you to continue to follow the podcast on Twitter. And if you haven't already done that, we're at Honest Actors. And also, if you wouldn't mind, to share some of your favourite moments using the hashtag Best of Honest Actors. Thank you very much. Here it is, episode 8. Yeah, episode 8 with John Heffernan. Enjoy.
All right, we are recording. So I have a list of questions, John, that I ask all the time. And some of them have never been asked. Some of them have, I've just always thought that's a terrible question. But every time I go to edit the questions, I think, no, I'm going to leave that in because it will find its place at some
point.
You
never know.
Exactly, you never know. It depends on the interview. But first, before we start that, thanks very much for taking time out to do this, because I know you're in the midst of other things. Thank you very much. So I'll start where I normally start, which is how did you get into acting? What was your route into the industry?
I got into acting through a love of theatre, really, more than acting itself. But there was a series that came out when I was about 11 called Shakespeare, The Animated Tales. Mm-hmm. I just became fascinated by the stories, really.
They were great, actually.
Did you watch them?
Yeah, they were great.
You're the first person. Like, yeah, normally when I mention them, there's sort of blank, but I thought they were just
brilliant. I remember those.
Brilliant.
Yeah. And they were quite stylistically kind of like odd as well. Like, they didn't look like any other cartoons at the time. I remember them being like slightly...
Yeah, well, they were all done in different ways. So you had stop motion animation, and then they had some of them were done on glass.
I mean, there were ones done on glass. Where the palette was quite narrow as well, where there was, I can't remember which one it was, but yeah, I remember watching those, but I might have been...
Some of them are absolutely, I mean, I've watched them again more recently. Yeah, funny enough, I thought, oh, I'll just put them on there. It's still available on DVD. They used a lot in schools, and some of them are still
fantastic. So what age were you then when you spotted those?
About 11, when they were originally on telly. And I had a very kind mum who said, well, do you want to go to the theatre and see the plays properly? And we were living in Essex, and so we just took the train along to the Barbican, where the RSC were at the time, and then I ended up spending every Saturday afternoon watching matinees of Shakespeare plays, and so it was from that, really.
So that's how you get it. I mean, I suppose it's nice that
your mum was able to identify there was a way of expanding that interest into something else. But that's not necessarily, there's a lot of people who get into theatre and then don't necessarily make the jump to actually doing it. So how does the transition happen from a kid who's really interested in these animations, whose mother takes him to see theatre at the Barbican, to becoming the kid in the Barbican Auditorium who thinks, I would like to do that, as opposed to, I really enjoy watching this?
Well, for a very long time, it was, I was just enjoying watching it, and I wanted to be a theatre critic for a really long time, because it was just, I enjoyed it more than anything else, watching performances. It wasn't until I went to uni, really, and the Drama Society there at Bristol, that I really got into the acting side of it. And it took off from there. But it was the world I found completely intoxicating, the idea of telling stories. That's what, and I thought, well, what's the best way of doing that? Well, the best thing is being in the heart of it, which is, I suppose, I knew I couldn't write. I didn't think I had any talent for that, for playwriting, and I'm always very envious of actor friends of mine who can write as well, and there are many of them. Increasingly, in the last couple of years, it feels like, my goodness, that's not fair. How come you're able to do that as well, you bastard? But so I concentrated on acting, and then
so what did you go to Bristol to study?
English and drama.
Oh, so there was
I was playing around with it, but I was still seeing it from quite an academic perspective, really. And it was a very academic course; it wasn't very practical.
Was there any resistance then from your family, whenever, I suppose, you had to go home at some point, and or they asked how the things were going with the theatre criticism route? And, you know, was there any resistance to the idea that you might want to be an actor, that was something you were going to pursue seriously?
Not really. There wasn't much. There's not a huge amount of history in it. It's in my family, and where it is, it's quite distant. And my mum has always been incredibly supportive of me, and I was very lucky in that I got a grant at drama school, otherwise I might not have been able to do it. So I was quite grateful from a financial point of view, but my mum was always very supportive of me in that regard.
So what was the first time that you remember taking to the stage with that sense of you being either an actor or someone who was on the path to becoming an actor? What was your first kind of serious appearance? first serious appearance on a stage as an actor? See it through to the end, why not?
You got it. I don't know if I had one. I just remember this a kind of escalating feeling that there was of getting a huge buzz and adrenaline kick of being on stage and playing. I had great opportunities at university in the Drama Society there of playing really cracking parts with a really lovely bunch of people who I'm still very much in touch with, and I found all that very addictive. And there was a great range of roles, which, you know, you're very lucky if that gets replicated, I think, once you move into the profession. But when you're at university or you're at drama school, you think, oh gosh, this is fantastic. You know, I can play Salieri and Amadeus one term, and then the next term I'm in a, you know, Molière farce. And that was great, the variety of it. So it was that, really, rather than one particular.
So you go to drama school. With all the expectations, I imagine, that come with that, you know, going into drama school, you probably feel like when you come out of that, you're going to be an actor, fully formed and ready to go. What was your first job then when you came out the other side?
It was a production by English Touring Theatre of Hamlet.
Just down there?
Just up the road. Have you worked there? Have you worked?
No. Oh. In that building many times.
Yeah.
Some for some successful, many more unsuccessful auditions.
Yes. Yeah, maybe it's the rehearsal room that breeds it, I don't know. But so that was my first job, with lots of children of famous people who probably, you know, they're very good in their own right, but it was quite strange because Ed Stoppard was Hamlet, obviously son of Sir Tom, and then Chris Patton's daughter, Alice Patton, was
It was Ophelia. Yeah. It was quite strange. A strange coincidence. But yeah.
At that point then, how do you feel your career is going to progress? Like, at that point, how do you see it going? Do you have great aspirations? Do you have a slightly more realistic sense of what a career might be? How, looking back, how realistic, I suppose, do you think your sense of what your career might be was back then?
I think my expectations were fairly low.
Really?
Yeah. I was just desperate to be... I just wanted to work in the theatre.
Yeah.
I didn't have any other aspirations, and I just wanted to... I thought, if I can somehow find a way of getting myself to work at the RSC or anything like that in some capacity, like, you know, just standing at the back at some point in my career,
yeah,
then that would be... And I meant it genuinely. Yeah. And I remember everyone had to meet the principal at the end of our course, and he said, "Okay, so what do you envisage doing? What's your plan?" And I said, "I want to work in the theatre. That's what I'd like to do." And he went, "Well, that's nonsense. There's no work in the theatre. It accounts for about 25% of most jobs out there. So you need to change your expectations."
Wow.
And I was quite shocked by that.
I'm quite shocked by that.
Yeah. Especially as the course, as most drama, maybe they're not now, but certainly 12 years ago when I graduated, they're entirely geared towards a career in the theatre. We got 2 days on screen technique.
Well, what have we been doing?
What the hell? Exactly. What have you been doing? What's this charade for the last 2 years?
You could have told us.
Yes,
sooner.
I know. You're saying now? But haven't we paid you? Yeah. It was a bit odd, but... yeah, so that was all I was after, really.
What a dick.
Yeah.
He's not listening.
No, he's definitely not listening.
So you had a fairly realistic kind of sense of what that might be then for someone just coming out of drama school. Did you have a sense of that in a context of what your peers expected? Did a lot of them expect or were their aspirations more towards the screen?
I think it was a mixture, and then I think there were probably some in the class who over the course had realised that actually acting wasn't for them. That definitely happened. So there was a combination of responses, but that was something which I was very keen on, and I was very aware of how difficult it was as a professional. Like, I hadn't obviously worked as an actor by that point of view, but I'd as a summer job worked front of house at the up in Stratford and at the National Theatre, and sort of hung around a bit as much as I could, and I've got the sense of how hard it was to find work as an actor. And so I thought, okay, if I can just cling on to some theatre work, then I'll be okay.
So transitioning into a kind of wider chat here, what I normally do is to contextualise someone for, say, a listener that hasn't heard of the actor I'm interviewing or isn't aware of their work. But also just to kind of, you know, give you a chance to identify the kind of actor that you see yourself as. What's the thing, the job you're most proud of? And that's a really difficult question, I know. It can be for a variety. It could be because it was significant, because you got to stand at the back of the RSC. It could be because, you know, you played a particular part you've always wanted to play, or because you did a piece of new writing that, you know, changed your life. Whatever reason, and on the understanding that I'm sure you can answer this a dozen different ways, but if you could, if there's one that kind of pops to the front of your mind, what would it be if there was a piece of work that was to identify you?
Yeah,
tough.
It is. It is.
Knowing that there will be people who won't be mentioned and they'll be gutted.
Yeah, so that's a really difficult question. It's a very difficult question because it's impossible to separate from the circumstances around the job.
Yeah.
It's not just, it doesn't exist in a vacuum. There's other factors as well.
In context, what felt like the most significant thing at the time, I suppose, is another way of phrasing that.
I was in a production of Richard II up at the Tobacco Factory in Bristol, which was an amazing experience for me, because it was the first time, I suppose, I'd played a lead on stage. I think I'm right in saying by that point. And I just felt I felt incredibly lucky to be playing that part. I know that sounds like such a cliche to say something like that, but it was something about the journey that that character goes on was just the most rewarding thing to do after night. Someone who has everything and sees himself as divinely ordained by God to be in the position that he is, to suddenly reaching, he has this speech at the end in Act 5. I don't know if you know it, but he talks about that no man can be happy unless he is content with being nothing. It's almost like a Buddhist philosophy that he speaks of in the last act. And so it was wonderful. And in a rather intimate space there, a very close company of actors. And that was a very special one.
Something in that particular quote is definitely something in that no man can be happy unless he's happy to. What's the quote?
Yeah, with nothing shall be. Oh, I'm going to misquote it. But something like, "No man shall be eased till with nothing shall be eased till he be pleased with being nothing." It's something like that. I'm dragging it from the back of my brain from about 6 or 7 years ago. But it's, yeah.
That's great.
It's just,
So that's the one of the jobs you're kind of, it stands out. The process of getting jobs then, you've already talked about how you were aware that it wasn't easy to find work as an actor, but from your time at the front of house jobs in the RSC and the National. Do you enjoy the process of auditioning? Some people do, some people don't. Do you find it pleasurable, pleasant, rewarding?
No. No, in a word, no. I don't. I could probably count on one hand the number of times when I have really got a buzz out of it, when it feels like there's a genuine connection between the director or whoever's leading the meeting, and something exciting happens in the room. But on the whole, no matter how many times I try and tell myself, just see it as a workshop, John, just see it as something where you're just throwing around ideas. It's not a test. They're not judging you. Of course they're judging you. You can play all the mental games you like, but there is a power play at work. And I find them very intimidating, and I've just had, and yes, it's just terrifying. It is.
So those half a dozen that you've really enjoyed, is that because you felt they've gone well, or is that because of something greater than that? Like, do you know when it's gone well, or do you have that kind of blur when you come out of, I don't know?
No, I don't think you know that it has gone well. You can be, there's so much bullshit, isn't there? You can be told, oh my God, you're fantastic. And then, radio silence afterwards. I think very often there's just, all that you want for, I think, as an act, or all that I want for as an actor, is there to be some kind of dialogue.
Yeah.
Whenever you walk into a room and you feel as though you're being asked to present, while the boss just
sits behind folds, desk.
Sits behind their desk or whatever, and folds their arms and says, "Come on, then." I'd rather the ground just opened up before I, started speaking.
So you go in, you want a dialogue. When you come out then, the other side of it, and you're walking out of the theatre, spotlight, wherever it is, do you just put it behind you, or do you carry some of that anxiety that you've talked about with you for a period of time after that?
Yeah, I do. I do, and I wish I didn't. I wish I didn't. I'd love to... in fact, talking to you about listening to Tom's interview when he was saying, you have to stop thinking about it. I remember him saying, and I wish I had that mental strength, but I don't. I go over and over it, and I drive my Agent Mad saying, any word, any updates, no. Anything else?
And do you get updates? This is one of the things that came up over the course of with the blog and stuff. People saying they wanted to get a no. It was the most infuriating thing was not getting a no, was that sense of it just somehow just gradually disappearing into the soft focus, and then eventually just, you know, over the hill and the next thing comes along.
Yeah.
Do you crave that final answer that you were unsuccessful is an important part of that communication that you crave?
Oh, definitely. I think that's, absolutely. But I think that's what they're campaigning for with Equity at the moment, aren't they, for that? Yeah, they just let things sort of trundle on indefinitely, and you're left completely none the wiser for weeks or months.
Usually when I see a poster for something, and I think, oh, I didn't get that.
Yes, exactly, yeah. All right, that didn't go my way then.
I remember flicking pages in a magazine once. It was two features and two films back to back, which I got quite close to and hadn't got. And the first one I thought, oh, fuck, I can't read that, and turned the page and was like, no! Yeah, so that's when you find out, right?
Yeah. It's terrible. It's an appalling way to treat people. I don't know if any other profession that do that. You know, no. You at least have the courtesy of
Dear John.
Getting back. Yeah.
Do you have people you see regularly at auditions who you consider rivals? And I mean rivals in the kind of gentlest sense of people that you think, oh, they're here. Of course they are.
Well, you hope that the casting director has been diplomatic enough to put
you beside
another character before you or after you, so you're not literally in a room of people who are identical in an identical casting bracket.
Or so you assume, but they might have not decided which way they're going with it.
There could be, yes, it could be,
you know, that's a very bold assumption.
Or, you know, Trisha Routledge could be equally right for the same part. But yes, there are. And after a while you can't, and it changes, I think, as well, which is quite interesting. Like the people who I thought, oh, I'm in the same casting as X, suddenly it changes. You're not. Something moves, and you're sort of. It's to do with the. Yeah, I think quite often you're seen in a particular way, and then that changes. Like for a while, when I got out, I'd play lots of sort of geeks. I found myself, I'm playing lots of sort of nerds and geeks and all the rest, which is fine. And then more recently, I found myself playing like monsters and villains. And
how has that happened? It's not a bad transition.
No, it's not bad. But yeah, you do become aware definitely of the people around.
Are the people you see, to take that to the next level, are the people you see and you would think, well, then I'd give it to them. They'll get it.
Oh, definitely. I'm sure. I'm sure other actors think the same. But yeah, I definitely think that. I mean, that's my sort of default position. Right. Of course.
I mean, I'm just glad my upside down reading is terrible. That you go into a room, a casting suite, and you look at the list.
Oh yes,
and they've got it in front of them. So what's your name when you said John Heffernan? And they go to check your name up. But
can you do that? So you can't see not even the photo.
I'm so bad at it. Like I wish it was better, but at the same time, I'm so glad I'm terrible at it. Because every time I try to do it, I should know. I've never once been able to successfully identify another actor upside down.
No.
Not once. It's probably for the best.
Yeah, I think it probably is for the best.
Yeah. Oh, you guys. Buy tickets to the best theatre in London the new way. With the TodayTix app, getting great offers and access to exclusive tickets has never been easier. With TodayTix Rush, you won't have to queue at the box office for hours to get day seats, and you can access big savings with their lotteries for shows like the ones I've listed on previous occasions. Yes, I forgot to bring my mobile phone in here to record this, so I'm unable to check the app. But imagine, if you will, me listing some shows that are on the West End, which are available on the TodayTix app. Those are the shows I'm talking about. Download TodayTix, the theatre ticket app, from the App Store and Google Play, and see theatre differently. STD.
An agent once told me an actor's only ever truly happy once they get a call to say they've got a job, and the 5 minutes after that. Because after that 5 minutes passes, then the self-doubt kicks in. right? Now that says a lot about the agent and his relationship to me at the time. Not my current agent, I have to say. It's my very, very first agent a long time ago. But I think there's something, if not self-doubt, there's definitely something of truth in that. I've always felt that there's that a moment of elation, and whether or not it's self-doubt, it's that kind of reality of, now I've got to go and live in somewhere else for 2 months, or now I've got to go and think about losing some weight, or, you know, whatever it is, all those things kick in.
Yeah.
Do you recognise yourself in that kind of statement of, you're never happy for the 5 minutes after you get a job?
Yes, I do recognise it. The elation probably lasts less than 5 minutes for me.
Right.
Probably...
what kind of things kick in post job discovery elation, job award offer elation? What kind of things start to eat away at that?
Well, all of the things you mentioned, so, you know, there's certainly, and I've got a 2-year-old girl now, and so I start thinking about the practical, there just seems to be a lot more practical things, considerations, all of those, and the massive one of, how am I going to do it? Am I going to be able to pull this off? I've certainly had job offers where I've thought, this is incredibly flattering, but how on earth am I going to convince or persuade people about this? But then there are moments of elation within that. I mean, you can, there are definitely moments of elation during the job, but very often it's the enormity of the task ahead suddenly goes from being something which is seesaws between being thrilling and terrifying.
Does the thrill, as you've gone on with your career, has the level of the thrill decreased? Do you find yourself more on the ups and downs are less peaks and troughs and more of a kind of a gentle rolling hills?
Yeah, I probably would say that, which makes me a bit sad. I wish in some ways it was a bit more dramatic and thrilling. But no, I'm not. The job that I remember being absolutely ecstatic about was when I got the call from my agent saying that I'm going to be spear carrying at the RSC for a year. I can still remember the call. I was absolutely.
Where were you?
I was in the front row. I was in the porch of our family house. It was the landline. And I was just absolutely ecstatic. It was the only place I wanted to be. And I stayed like it for a year. I didn't have any responsibilities, really. The ones I did have were fairly modest, and I could just be a sponge for a year and just soak up everything around me. It was amazing, and I don't think I've had that since. There's euphoria that you get. You know, pockets of euphoria in different ways, but nothing can quite beat that. I think that. Those things, those experiences early on.
Just bringing it then, so you talk about if one thing is elation, the other thing is terror. So it's that kind of joy and terror at the same time. Do you get nervous before going on stage? Do you get nervous before a first preview, a press night?
Yeah, yes, particularly previews. Yeah, to say, to the point where you think, okay, is this useful? That, you know, I've heard actors talk about a certain degree of adrenaline can really, you know, you don't want to be in a state of complete relaxation, do you? Otherwise, there's probably nothing's going to happen. You've got nothing to light the fuse, as it were, but too much, and it can be completely crippling and disabling.
Has that got less with time? Have you? If the peak of elation has got less. Has the terror of a first
no,
God,
I'm painting quite a bleak picture, but no, I don't think it has. No, no, I still get because I feel the responsibility more, I suppose, because I've been lucky in that the parts that I've played, particularly in the theatre recently, have been quite substantial, and so I feel quite a lot of responsibility to. You know, a lot of it feels on my shoulders.
And then coming out, you know,
you go through that. You go through press night, having, you know, been on your knees in a cold sweat before going on stage. You go on stage, you come off the next day or 2 days later, the reviews start to become available. Do you read them?
Yeah, I
don't,
do.
Don't pull the face like you're embarrassed. Like, because everybody says, I think everybody, when they're honest, will say they'll read them at some point. So a lot of people say, I'll read them when it's done.
Read them at the end.
But like, I can't imagine how you would possibly have that level of self-control.
I know. But I, yeah, but like,
have
you
they
say,
ever had a hugely detrimental impact?
Sorry?
Have they ever had a detrimental impact on you?
Yes. I mean, I've definitely had bad reviews. And I read one just before. It was so stupid, but it was in a Sunday paper, and there was a Sunday matinee, and I read it probably about half an hour before I was about to go on stage. And that was really not a clever idea, because that did not put me in the right headspace.
That was your one note for the whole show.
Yes, exactly. But quite often, particularly with newspaper reviews, there's so little space. There isn't the for critics. There isn't the space to go into the nuances of why something
it's
doesn't
about
work.
Nuances.
It's just condemning it or praising it to the skies or whatever it may be. And so quite often there's not much you can do with it. It's just saying, it's just saying I'm terrible. They're not saying what I can do to fix it. But I wish I could leave off reviews. It's a habit which I'd love to kick.
Bit of a jump in a way, but I suppose at some point in the interview this was going to happen. How important do you feel luck is?
Luck?
Mm.
Yeah, I'd say it plays a big, really big role. It depends on whether if you're in the right place at the right time, whether your face fits, whether you know certain people as well. That's an ugly truth, but I do think that's the case. I think there is a lot of, I couldn't say otherwise when I think about the people in my year at drama school. Some of them were absolutely brilliant and they've really, really struggggled. And there's quite often I feel there's just no rhyme or reason.
Have you been lucky, do you think?
Yeah. Without a doubt. Without a doubt. Yeah. All sorts of circumstances that got me, that meant that I got a very good agent mm-hmm. who got me into certain rooms early on that led to jobs, which led to other jobs. You need something. You need luck to start that chain reaction, I think.
Do you believe in big breaks then? Do you believe in that notion of, you know, a golden opportunity that lays everything, makes everything available to you?
Yes, I do. I do. I think certain things can transform. You can have a job which transforms your career. I've not had that, but I've seen it. I was in a production of a Terence Rattigan play called After the Dance. Benedict Cumberbatch was in it, and halfway through the run, I won't forget it, the first episode of Sherlock came out, and I saw him turn. It sounds like I'm exaggerating, but I promise you it's not. I saw him turn literally overnight from the Saturday night of the show, from him being a really, really well-respected, obviously brilliant actor, to coming in on the Monday. And I remember sitting with him in the canteen and him saying, I've just been spotted at the cheese counter in Tesco's. And he turned into a star, and suddenly there were queues around the block for the play. And it was just that one part which, you know, it just completely exploded his career. And then he was getting phone calls. And within 2 weeks, he was getting phone calls from Steven Spielberg asking him to do War Horse. And amazing to see that in close proximity. So I think it definitely happens.
At the kind of the less lucky, what's the longest you've gone without working?
5 months, 6 months.
How does that feel?
Very hard, I have to say. And I'm sure lots of people have gone on a lot longer. So that maybe to some people doesn't sound like an awful lot at all, but...
it's all relative, isn't it?
It is all relative. And yeah, I really, really struggled because I didn't know I had a job coming up, and it just felt as though this could be it indefinitely. And yeah, it was a psychological struggle.
So in the depths of that, does jealousy ever take hold? Do you ever, I'm sure you're not when you're working, or you're less inclined to when you're working. But when you're not working for 5 or 6 months and you see other people who are, could be peers, could be people you're not even competing with, just other people working, do you find that difficult? Or have you always been able to separate your own work from that of others?
I wouldn't call it jealousy, because I just think that I wouldn't call it that.
Does it make you feel worse to see other people working, I suppose? So it's not about jealousy, but it's that thing of comparing your own, at that point, seeming lack of success.
There is a certain degree of that. And in the last couple of years, I've developed a habit, which is probably really unhealthy, of when I have been out of work, of when I watch a TV program and I see that there's a part that I could potentially have been seen for and I was available, I've sometimes thought to myself, why wasn't I seen for that?
I can't watch things that I've been up for and haven't got. I really can't.
Right, yeah.
I probably should. There's probably something practically, there's probably some argument for saying we should watch Who Got It and see what you can learn, but I just can't.
Yeah. It's really hard, isn't it?
Or plays. Like, it stops me going to see plays. If I've been up for something and I don't get it, I can't. I just can't.
Yes.
I can't. Because it'll make me feel really sad.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. There's definitely... And I had that experience recently. I went to see a play of something I've been up for. But the actor, who's a friend... because that's the other thing. They're always friends.
Yeah.
So which makes it even more complicated. But he's so different from me. Yeah, it's very, very difficult. But rather than looking over at other people, you've just got to try and somehow find a way of keeping the faith that keeping the faith that something's gonna come up. But it was last year that break happened, and I found it really hard, really, really hard. And you're thinking, you know, especially when you've got a little family as well, I was thinking, oh God, this is like, I'm really not pulling my weight here. And people just think you're some kind of slacker because you're just, you know, just idling. And yeah, it's
resting is what
difficult. Resting, yes.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah.
And
so have you had periods then?
Oh, of course, yeah. I'm in the midst of one
right now.
But I mean... It's that thing that I find difficult is when you have a few years when you're busy and you feel like that not working thing's behind you.
Yes.
And you're on a path and you've taken a step or a couple of steps, or you do a job that you're particularly proud of, and then something happens and you realize, actually, I'm still just another actor looking for work.
Yeah.
Whenever I'm out of work, I'm just another actor looking for work. And your CV gets you so far, but then you have to go into the room and be the person, the face has to fit, the kind of, you know, everything else has to go in your favor. So, I mean, I'm in that point now where I'm like, what am I, I'm 37 now, what am I doing? If I decided to stop doing this, what would I do?
Yes.
Well, you know, that's where I am. Anyway, that segues.
But you're right, and it also isn't, I think it's like to do with an age thing as well, of you kind of think you, and I didn't really see that when I was at drama school. I didn't think about what it'd be like in 30s, but you kind of think, thought in my 20s, and I thought, oh, well, if I don't get a job, then that's going to be really hard and painful, but I can find something to fill the gap, and it'll be fine. But when you're in your 30s and your 40s and 50s,
you're not pulling your weight,
you start thinking, oh, this isn't such a good look. This is harder.
You don't want, a little girl next door to me asked the other day, she looks after our dog sometimes. She said, what do you do for a living? Because I'm always around. And I said, oh, I'm an actor. And she says, would I know you? And I always go, no. Have you been in anything? No. Are you acting at the minute? No. And it took something about the fact that she's like 10 years old makes it all the worse.
because she can't see why a grown man would be in his garden of a Tuesday afternoon doing nothing.
Yeah.
And her kind of struggling to process this made me feel even worse. I was like, yeah, you're kind of right, Ruby. Like, what am I doing with my life? Shit, Ruby, I'm so glad you came in. But anyway, so what's the worst thing about being an actor? What's the hardest thing?
Rejection, I think.
Does it get easier? Have you developed any way of coping with it or making it have less of an impact on you?
No. I think it's always hard. I think often with actors, because we have to go into for auditions so long, so frequently, it's almost seen as though something we're just automatically expected to cope with. And I think it's really hard. And I've, a member of my family going through is looking for jobs at the moment, and it's a huge deal for him. He's been working in a steady job for 20 years, and it's completely unknown territory for him. And he's finding it unbelievably stressful. And I thought, well, yeah. And I suppose this is what actors experience almost as a constant state. It's part of the deal, and the upside is you get constant variety in terms of your experiences from job to job. But the big downside is constantly having to put yourself forward and then being let down. And yeah, it's you do try and find some ways of dulling that as time goes by, but you can't ever completely, I don't think. And sometimes it's good not for it to be dull. Well, like sometimes it can be, can use it as fuel.
That's lovely. Yeah, sometimes.
Sometimes you can, it can be, it can fire you up.
Do you think there's a psychological impact long-term of that process though? Do you think that thing of being out of work, being in work, being out of work, of the kind of the fact that you said that the terror hasn't lessened over time, but the joy has. So there's kind of, if we look at it fairly, if you took you and me out of this and wrote that down and read it black and white on a script, you'd think, God, that's quite bleak. That's as a monologue, that's quite bleak.
Yeah.
Do you think that has a long term psychological effect?
Probably. It's probably too soon for me to start talking about it. You have to interview me again in 30 years and I'm rocking back and forth and drooling. But there might well be. The problem is no one talks about it. There's that brilliant, did you see that documentary that David Harewood made about, I think he called it On Failure or something, and he interviewed loads of actors who talk and say, this is a massive taboo, I'm going to interview actors about jobs they haven't got and times when they haven't worked. And it was so brilliant hearing people, and he interviewed big, like Damian Lewis and people like that. But it was really useful to hear that being aired, because we're sort of shy about not working. Yeah.
But pretend you're working all the time.
I suppose because we have to sell ourselves. We are our own business. Yeah. And so we have to...
Do you believe that?
Flaunt ourselves. Believe what?
Do you believe that we are our own business? Like, there is a big argument, I think, between the kind of American model of, the social media spin of, like, of having a website and a glossy photograph and, your agent and your publicist and your manager and that kind of spin of... John's really in demand at the minute. Whenever you don't want to do a job, you never say you don't want to do it. You say John's not available.
He's not available right now.
You know that whole spin we put around it. Like, but that, because you hear that a lot now from drama school graduates. Of that whole thing about a brand. I'm a brand. I've got to know my brand. Do you believe that?
Well, apparently so. I mean, I can't do any of it. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. Whenever I go on Twitter, I mostly go on it to say that I've just seen a show which I really like. You should all go. I'm really bad at going on it to say, this is my show. Come.
But isn't that better? Isn't there something stronger about not being the person who says, look at me,
constantly.
But my agent got encouraged all of his clients to come to his office about 2 years ago for a social media presentation, a masterclass with diagrams and pie charts of how we should use
social media,
Twitter, and it was amazing. He showed us the last few minutes of the Great British Bake Off final and the peak in tweets as the program went on, and how we can engineer that sort of thing for ourselves.
It is fascinating, and I'm sure it is necessary, but part of me just wants to hold on to the fact that, like, it's that thing of how important is luck. Part of you wants to believe not that important, but you know it is. Part of you wants to believe that if you're good, that even if you're not on Twitter and you don't have a hugely lucky moment, that somehow you'll find work, or you'll get busy, or someone will, you know, find out that, oh, he's really good, or she's really good. Or, but there is a kind of that unspoken thing of, don't say you're not working. Don't say, you know, be on there talking when you're on set. Don't go on Twitter if you're unemployed and feeling down, because, you know, it's an odd, it feels like, because it's one of the knock-on effect is people who use social media more get depressed more. Like, there's various scientific studies to show Facebook usage correlates with levels of depression. So the
really?
People who suffer depressive tendencies will have peaks and troughs that coincide with their use of Facebook, because it's about comparing your own perception of your own failures with other people's fake successes. So that, and if I'm getting long-winded, but effectively as actors, we all do this to each other. So by going on and trying to manufacture a spike and trying to get as many followers and talk about our work, even when we're not working, and by not admitting the times when we're not working, all the other actors who go on there don't interpret that as we probably should, as going, well, that's just nonsense. Of course they're not working all the time. Actually, what happens is they all go, oh, he's really busy and I'm not really busy, and oh, I'm a failure and he's not. And so there's this kind of, that's the thing I'm experimenting with, because every time I tweet about myself in a promotional way, a part of me dies. Like, I feel like I've bought into something that I shouldn't have bought into. But equally, every time I think about tweeting something negative, like as in I'm not working or I feel really shitty at the minute, you feel like you're one of those people who's waiting for people to go, oh no, Jonathan,
here's an electronic hug. Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it is an odd, I don't quite know the answer to it, but it is something I wrestle with, as in what is the point of all that? And a friend of mine who's an actor said he always stops himself before he tweets and says, is it edifying? Like, does it serve a purpose beyond self-promotion? And I think it's a really useful exercise, but it's tough, especially if your agent is kind of, you know, is big on it and wants you to push it. And
as I say, I've kind of ignored it, because I don't. And it's very strange, and I can't really get my head around it. And also, I really admire the actors. I tend to admire are people who are sort of absent from
all of that.
The ones that I really like are the ones who just get on with it.
Yeah. So we're talking about the kind of long-term psychological impact. The kind of positive of that is a lot of actors talk about jobs having changed them, about that thing that we do, which is to step inside and try and empathize with another set of circumstances, another character's life choices and conditions have made them more empathetic generally to other people's circumstances. And you find that actors do tend to generally be politically in a certain kind of end of the political spectrum.
Yes.
Are you aware of any job in particular having had that kind of impact on you, where you felt like, that's changed me? I look at the world differently because I played that character, because I did that play, or because I feel like I'm putting pressure on you to say, yes, I've had an epiphany whilst playing Richard II. Put it like this. I suppose in a long-term thing, had you not been an actor, and this is almost impossible to answer, certainly in any scientific way, but do you feel that young kid from Essex who'd come to the Barbican to see shows, had he went down the path of academia and being a critic, do you think you'd be the same person?
No. Definitely not. No, acting, I think, is a probably ended up being a massive part of who I am, and the parts that I've played are a large, have contributed hugely to that. I suppose there isn't one single one similar to your question about if there's a part which has defined me in some way. I think it all adds up to each job that you take, hopefully, will expand your understanding in some way. It's one of the great gifts of the job that when you start work on something, you think, oh, this is a fantastic excuse. So I'm about to start rehearsing on this play, St. George and the Dragon, and I'm starting to learn about, as much as I can, about English history, but also about specifically about Chaucer, about nationhood, about what it means to be English and our relationship with our flag and the emblems of our nationality. How fantastic to do that when, you know, I played Oppenheimer, suddenly getting an excuse to try and learn about, I'm the least scientifically minded person, but learn all about physics. All of that, I think, is tremendous. And then, yes, learning how other people from different walks of life, how that informs who they are, and you hope that the job will increases your empathy and understanding. I'd like to think that. And that will continue to happen, and that you're always learning from others.
Always becoming a better pub quiz player as well. That's the thing about actors.
Well, that is
that level of general knowledge, like, is insane. If you talk to an actor in the 60s who's worked fairly consistently, they will know about so many.
Yeah, I suppose that's why, unbelievable, isn't it? Because they just
picking at different things. Have you ever considered giving up? All that said, has there ever been a point where you've thought, do you know what? Maybe I should, you know, go and get a regular gig.
No, I haven't. In spite of everything that I said, I haven't, because I do love it.
That's the question. And what's the best thing? We've talked about what the worst thing is. If you haven't ever given up, in spite of all those things, what's the best thing?
I still love it. I'm still addicted to that memory of that high of feeling I'm on the RSC stage. I'm you know, that 12-year-old watching Robert Stevens as King Lear. You know, I'm still trying to sort of recapture something of that of how it felt to experience that. And so I've never been. I honestly don't know what I'll do apart from anything else. Mm-hmm. But there are far more pluses than minuses to being an actor. You know, you meet the most fantastic people. It's always changing. You're always on your, being kept on your toes. Mm-hmm.
In every possible way.
In every possible way. I've not thought about it. I'd like to do something on the side, but I'd love to do something like a friend of mine has been doing an OU degree on the
right.
I quite like that idea.
In what? What would you do?
I'd really like. Well, I always enjoy going to exhibitions, so I'd quite like to do art history.
That'd be nice.
Yeah. Have you ever done anything like that?
So I did the university thing first. So I did too many degrees before I started acting.
How many degrees? Three. So you've got 3 degrees?
Well, I dropped out of the last one because I just thought this is too much.
So what are they in? That's amazing. You got 3 degrees.
One of them's in drama.
Isn't that a pop group, 3 degrees?
Yeah. Well, one of them's in drama. One of them's in European literature and culture. And one of them was a PhD, but I gave up on that one after 6 years. Do you consider yourself an artist?
Actors really struggle with this question, and I ask it purposely because I want to see people squirm. Right? So I say, people can't see you when I ask this question, but I say, and I see in you the desire to want to say yes or believe yes, but also the feeling that socially it's unacceptable to call oneself an artist.
Okay, what is an artist? Is an artist this broad umbrella term that we apply to all the artists? I mean, if someone came up to me and said, if that little girl said to me, "What do you do? Are you an artist?"
No, I'm an actor.
I'd say no. If I hear a famous actor saying I'm an artist,
you think?
Then I'm afraid I would snigger a bit.
But have you ever thought of another actor as an artist? Have you ever watched another actor give a performance and not necessarily? I'm saying consciously at the time when you, sir, are an artist, you, madam, are an artist. But I mean, do you think you could apply at the other actors happily and go, yeah, well, actually, that person is an artist of sorts?
Yeah, I think at its absolute best.
So what are you if not an artist? What are you, a tradesperson? Are you a craftsman?
I think there's a lot of legitimacy in saying that in a little bit of humility and saying my job is not to get in the way. And there's a kind of pure connection between a play and the audience, and you could. There is an argument.
I like that.
There's an anything else is ego.
I like that a lot.
Would you say?
I find it hard because people have answered this question various ways, and I've agreed with a lot of people who've given very different answers.
But then again, sometimes you watch performances in which you think you have. The most ridiculously obvious example, but if you take Mark Rylance in Jerusalem, you read that play, it's an astonishing play, and then you see the performance and you think, okay, you've lifted that play and you've made all of that. I don't know if you saw it.
He does, absolutely.
But everything at the beginning, I don't think is in the play or is in the original text. And I thought, okay, that is something extraordinary that you have somewhere in your brain.
He's created
a connection and it's unforgettable, and I can't quite imagine, against cliche, but I can't imagine anyone else taking on that role because of something that you have you have thrown into the mix. But yes, personally, I think that I would worry that puts the actor too much front and center by saying, I'm an artist.
I quite like those I quite like the other end of the performances where you don't think, oh, this is about that actor. You know what I mean? I quite like where it's about serving something.
If my attention is being drawn to the fact of like, oh, look what you're doing there, then
it's done.
Then it's the spell's broken.
We're supposedly in the quickfire round. So, do you consider yourself successful?
Moderately. Yes.
Would your younger self...
Successful enough.
Would your younger self agree with that? Would that...
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so the guy at the ETT... Yeah.
My younger self would think I'm a superstar. compared to what he thought that I was... Yeah. My 20-year-old self thought I was going to just be doing... thought that I was just going to be spear carrying. So in relation to that, it's a... past any kind of expectation.
What's that quote from Richard II again?
That I with nothing shall be pleased till I be eased with being nothing.
Something in that.
Yeah.
Could go back to that guy at the ETT, the first job, or just before, just after, around that time, and offer him some advice that would help with the years in between to either, mediate some of the ups and downs or to help him through. What kind of advice might you offer?
I would say keep the faith, really, that to keep in mind the long that you're in it for the long haul, and that it's not to get too hung up on every single audition and job prospect, to enjoy the moment, really. I think I've spent far too long when I've been even when I've been in jobs thinking about what's next, and you can sort of see, and I think quite a lot of actors do it thinking, oh, what's going, rather than actually being present in the moment, what we're asked to do on stage, you know, we're not very good at doing sometimes off. So yeah, that.
Do you worry more about your health or financial security?
My health?
Yeah.
In what respect?
When you think about things that keep you awake at night, are they health, work, financial security?
Yes, health. Recently, health. Weirdly, it's just odd that you should ask that question.
Being a parent,
Being
a parent, perhaps changes.
I think it maybe is. Yeah, funny. It's just funny that you asked that question because it would definitely not have been sort of 18 months ago or even a year ago, but just recently. I think about it a lot, and I don't quite know why. And it might well be to do with parenthood. I suppose it feels like there's been sort of shocking items in the news, and might sound strange, but when Tim Pigott Smith passed away, who I only knew really in passing, I never worked with him, but it was so. I still haven't really got over that, really. I mean, just it seemed so sudden, and so without wanting to go incredibly serious, but yeah, the frailty of life, I suppose.
Yeah.
I feel a bit more aware of.
Final question, John. Are you in anything at the minute?
Starting rehearsals on this play at the National next month, St. George and the Dragon.
So that's future. I said, are you in anything at the minute?
At the minute?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Okay. what, as in right now?
Classic actor. I've just about to start this. You are actually. You're.
Well, I'm doing right now. I am. I'm doing a workshop. Yeah. There's some tea. Yes.
It's so hard, isn't it?
It is. Well, that's that thing, isn't it? Being in the moment. You can't, I've done this and maybe this is coming up and all the rest of it. It's hardwired into us to. Yes, ordinarily, I would probably say nothing, but this week I'm doing a workshop.
Yeah, brilliant. Listen, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much again for taking time out of that particular workshop to do this.
I hope you
haven't get into trouble.
I
won't. Being back late from lunch, but it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
And that's that episode 8 with Mr. John Heffernan. Thank you to John for his time again. Thank you to the National Theatre Studio for the use of their library space in which to record that interview. And thanks to you for listening. You can, of course, go back and listen to the previous 7 episodes from Series 3. There are also 26 regular episodes from the past 2 series and a few bonus eps as well. There are 7 follow-up interviews with the emerging actors and also a special live episode which we recorded for Equity. They're all available on iTunes, on Spotify, on Acast, on Stitcher, and wherever you listen to your podcasts. And they are, and will always be, free. You can do a little bit in return by leaving a rating and a review on iTunes if you haven't done already. You can also follow the podcast on Twitter at Honest Actors, and please do consider tweeting, sharing the good news, and if you would, and if you have some, perhaps sharing your favourite moments from the past 3 series using the hashtag Best of Honest Actors. Anyway, that is it from me. I have to go and put this together now, having just recorded the intro, outro and mid-bit. So a little bit more work to do from me. I've also got to email John Heffernan and tell him that his episode has not been lost, and that I still am alive and that it's going out today. So wish me luck. See you in a fortnight.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.